Good evening to you all, and welcome to Writers at Warwick, this evening with two outstanding poets. We have one of the extremely distinguished senior practitioners of the art in these islands, Douglas Dunn from Scotland, and we have a new voice whose first book is certainly one of the most acclaimed debuts for many years, Henry Shookman. I'd like to think that Douglas Dunn needs no introduction, but that would be a weaselly way of getting out of an introduction. I will say something for those of you who may happen to have been on another planet for some time. 1966, his first volume, Terry Street, is the point at which he becomes visible on the map of poetry in Britain. An extraordinary book, a very widely praised debut, a book which I suspect at times he's thought is not entirely characteristic of his voice, because he underwent something of a change of manner towards the end of the 70s, and in the 80s produced the book which for many years was probably the one that defined him in the public eye, Elegies. But nevertheless, I'm confident that many people like myself look to that first book, Terry Street, as an extraordinary debut volume. I've mentioned Elegies. That came 18 years later, 1984, a book of poems written after the death of his first wife from cancer. A very deeply moving book, very wonderfully crafted. It should be said that Douglas Dunn is widely thought of among his fellow poets as one of the great masters of his art in these islands. There have been many books since then, and most recently, The Year's Afternoon, and the book which you can buy outside if you happen to have a substantial amount available. It's £20. You may wish to wait for the paperback if you're on a limited budget, but it's a book you won't want to have missing from your shelf. The New Selected Poems, poems 1964 to 2000. Douglas Dunn was for many years a librarian in various places, including Hull, where he was not only a friend of Philip Larkin, but also very instrumental in promoting the local poetry scene in and around Hull. He's for now 12 years, I think, or 13, been professor at the University of St. Andrews. Is it 12 years?
I never say the word 13.
You never say the word 13. This man is a hotel masquerading as a poet. From all of that, you can infer his age for yourself, but since it's not a secret, I'll say that he turned 60 last October, and we're very glad in this year of his turning 60, so to speak, to have him here to read to us. Over on the far right from me, there is Henry Shookman. Henry Shookman comes, as it were, in various guises. I read that he's done various jobs beginning with TR. He's been a trombonist, a trawlerman, and another TR, travel writer. And as a travel writer, a very successful man. I don't know how successful the trawling was. certainly, I've got a suspicion that none of those successes could anywhere near equal the outstanding and conspicuous success of his poetry. Won the Daily Telegraph Arvon competition 2 years ago, well, in fact, 3 years now, 2000. And last year produced his first volume, From Cape, in Dr. No's Garden, which has almost silenced the critics into hushed reverence, except for the odd squawk, which goes something like, this is the most wonderful debut for years, and so on, The Times, and many other accolades of that kind. It very appropriately was shortlisted for the Forward Prize for the best first collection, and ridiculously didn't get it. Mercifully, it did get another similar prize, the Alborough Festival's prize for a best first collection. To my mind, in fact, that's, if anything, the higher honor. I'd just like to put in a little word for the Alborough Festival, which I believe is one of the most sensible and justly run poetry festivals in Britain. Wonderful little festival. I think it's a high honor. Henry Shookman has rapidly made a name for himself as a very accessible and at the same time extremely intelligent and percipient poet. I think we're in for a double treat this evening. Henry will read first a set of about 20 minutes. Douglas will read second for about 40. I'll just put in a little word of thanks at that point and remind you of your book buying and book signing duties and so on. And at that point, they will leave you with a brief encore of one poem apiece. That's the format, and I'll hand over now to Henry. Henry Schuttman.
Well, thanks very much for all of that, Michael. Before I start, I would also just like to say a big thank you to David Morley for inviting me to come and read tonight with a poet who is clearly one of the great living poets. I do think it's incontestable that some of Douglas's work ranks alongside the very best of people such as Thomas Hardy, and the company doesn't get better than that. It's a particular honor because a few years ago I was a student of Douglas's and couldn't have imagined that I might one day sort of be sharing the stage, albeit as a supporting act. The first poem I'm going to read is about an athlete, a Japanese ski jumper who caught my eye at the Nagano Winter Olympics, initially because he went by the splendid name Happy Harada. He also was the most erratic of Olympians and managed to have the very best and the very worst jumps in those games. And there was a particular nail-biting moment when the Japanese ski jump team as a whole was poised to win gold medals all round, and the last jumper to go was Happy Harada. I should just say that there's a kind of supplementary voice in this poem which is supposed to be the voice of a commentator. So if you can just try and imagine David Coleman at certain moments, which I hope will be clear. Happy Harada. It's Happy Harada on the bench now. 4 years he's been waiting for this jump. Harada pulls down his giant goggles and grins. He stands, releasing himself, sinks into the silver crouch, arms swept back like fins. The skis scuffle in their grooves like cutlery in a drawer. The wind presses against him, flattening the smile into his face. He hits the ramp. Yes, it's a big takeoff. He's certainly found a cushion this time. Oh, he's flying. The skis, a perfect V. The puffed aerofoils of his sleeves. Happy passes all the lines of the landing slope. A hum goes round the crowd. How's he gonna bring this one down? Telemark won't do it from that height. But he isn't coming down. Up, Happy goes, high above the crowd, who turn up their faces like a field of poppies, all their little flags drooping in awe as Happy Harada soars right over them, clean out of the arena. Well, what will the judges make of that? Just look at Nickin and the Finn shaking his head. He can't believe it. Happy is flying, flying high over Nagano, past the sushi places. There goes the cement factory far below. A cloud skits by just under his skis. He can almost taste it. A distant ambulance wails among hills. Happy watches as all the swallows of Nagano flock up to meet him. They lead him off over the temples of Mount Hiei, ducking and whistling like dolphins. I'm going to definitely come down to earth for the next one, which is, well, for a few months I tried to write a poem commemorating the birth of our first son after he arrived, and never quite seemed to manage it, and this poem is about as close as I ever got, which, as you'll see, isn't that close, really. Horses at Christmas. In our little house, credents were singing about the old cotton fields. The baby was flat on his back in front of the fire, eyes swimming with flame. Christmas morning, and you were at church. I thought of going to join you late. Instead, took the baby up to the horses. Out in the field, he started crying. Maybe I should have taken him to the bath of stone, the discipline of a savior, the sanctuary of hymns. But the horses saved us. To be close to them, so tough and nothing to do with us, and there breathing all over him, and the flaking mud on their necks where they had rolled, and the sucking of hooves as they walked the sodden field. The horses with their long heads watched us watch them. Then they turned, drumming the field, leaving us alone. The damp morning all about, the soaked grass underfoot, the baby's diaphanous ears going pink in the cold as silence bowed back to earth. I'm going to sort of skip a couple of generations now to a poem about my mother. Both my parents were quite, well, at times moderately keen, but not very accomplished musicians. this is about my mother's attempts with music. Piano solo. Years after my mother chose emptiness, at night, high in my room, I'd hear her at the piano, planting chords, waiting for them to grow into something. She never advanced from childhood lessons. She'd crackle flat a dry page of Bartok or Anna Magdalena and make the house's spine go cold. That was all her hesitant handfuls conjured. Misery, a lonely beginner always beginning again. A weather of notes I wished would pass. They trickled onto my sheets in the dark, each drop telling how sad a woman could feel even to have lost what made her sad. Another kind of generational move. This next poem is, in a way, a kind of tribute to my grandfather, my grandmother, who I never knew, died a decade before I was born. She and her husband, my grandfather, who I also never knew, had arrived in London in around 1910 from, well, escaping the pogroms in what was then Russia and is now Poland. And they got themselves to Gdansk in northern Poland and got on a ship to, well, thinking that they were going to America, and reached London and thought they were in America. And we've been here ever since. But this isn't really directly intended to be her. Schmaltz. By the way, I mean, ideally this would be read in a, you know, a nice thick Yiddish accent. So just try and imagine that. Yeah. Schmaltz. Chicken soup is magic. Here's the proof. Maybe if I'd opened the window a crack, it never would have happened. But late in the war, I tip the lid to let the steam off while the broth reduces to clear gold. Here's my stove up one end, and on the table at the other, there's the new baby, the seventh, the one we didn't want, but he was a boy. After six girls, you don't complain. There's no place for a baby like a warm kitchen. Plus, he's wrapped in my husband's army coat, a proper little bundle. The Germans find our house by mistake, drop one right through the roof. It's the new kind that drips, and where it drips, it burns. The girls are all up the road, thank God, at their auntie's. I dash into the kitchen, find a sight. Shouldn't have left the stove, is my first thought. The room's that smoky, I didn't see the fire was up the other end. Put my hand straight in the flame. There he is, snug in his basket, snug all right. Not a squeak or whimper from him. I don't stop to think what that means. I pull him out and make for the door. Outside, I hold him away to get a look, and my whole front's stained with grease. I wipe his cheek, the skin smooth as ever. Even with our house pouring smoke behind me, a tower of flame roaring from the roof, I can smell what it is on him. Schmaltz. While the room filled with fire, he'd been anointed, and it saved him. No one explained it. Even the doctor couldn't understand. He's a plump man, our Ruby, always has been, and loves a bowl of chicken soup with matzo. I get some ready whenever he comes. Oh, Mum, he says, not chicken soup again. He's only joking. Yes, it is. You ought to know what's good for you. He's an accountant, offices off Regent's Park, drives a BMW, just like half his sisters, the ones that didn't throw themselves away. Wanted to be a fireman, but wasn't tall enough. Changed his name, though, Cohen to Owen. Says it helps in today's Britain. I'm running out of breath, all this talking. What I'm saying is, I had a miracle in my life. Never underestimate a good bowl of soup. I'm going to read another one that has the same setting as that one about taking the baby up to the horses. And just in case anybody is interested, that happens to be a cottage that we used to live in on a farm somewhere between here and Stratford, not at all far from Stratford, in fact. Which, as you all will know, is the famous birthplace of the Teletubbies. Snowy morning. When we were 9 or 10 and used to play at dying, hands clasped to the chest. Goodbye, beautiful world, I love you. We didn't believe it could ever really be done. Say goodbye to everything. A gunshot wound in a Western could set us thinking, please, please don't die. Or a feathered mess that had been a pigeon squashed on the road. Even divinity class, that final sponge of vinegar on a spear tip. Goodbye, beautiful vinegar. Now, under the shag of decades, after so much contact with things, it takes a morning like this. Snow has fallen, a light crust. On the white field, green trails zigzag where the horses wandered. A crazy scribble shows where they fed. There they are now, two statues stooping. All the ewes are sitting, thawing their grass. Puddles crunch like caramel. Little snowfalls crumble down a hedge. The silver birch trembles in its own twigs' shadows. And under the rusty chestnut, I walk through a rain of crystals. There isn't much to say. This is a day that decides by itself to be beautiful. This field is a bride. How are we to say goodbye? Well, I'll end. I did one about my mum earlier, so I will do one about my dad, which I'm happy to be able to say he approves of, or has given it his imprimatur. Man peeing. My father was a man of small stature, but some standing. Important in some circles, he told me, pushing his glasses up his nose. Which way to the gents? He would ask the maitre d'. We'd place ourselves side by side before the high white wall. When he started to urinate, my father let out an arse squeal. He would laugh and I would laugh. He was warm to the touch. Clouds of steam rose from his pale stream. His thing was heavy and thick, a length of rope, a long toadstool, a mushroom nozzle emitting a twirled bore, a fireman's jet. When I saw it, I understood he was of another world. He would choose a spot and obliterate it. Afterwards, when he zipped it away, the zip said, uh-huh, in agreement. Come on, Boychik, ready? Full to my chin with delight, I'd nod because I was ready. I followed him past the swinging doors that chuckled behind us, back to the carpeted world, where the waiters and the women waited. Thank you.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be here and a great delight to share the reading with Henry, who, as he said to you, was a student of mine in my postgraduate course in writing at St. Andrews. Nice to know that I didn't waste my time. I'd like to start with a very short poem. In fact, it's a Clerihew. Disappointingly, since his death, the late Donald Dewar, who was the first minister of the Scottish Parliament, has been receiving an increasingly critical press as part of a campaign which deplores the expense of the marvellous new Parliament building, which is in the course of being constructed. The title of the poem is actually longer than the poem, and it goes, "On a memory of the late Donald Dewar, walking along the platform at Queen Street Station, Glasgow, head and shoulders taller than surrounding returning Ouija commuters, all pretending not to notice him. Though not as tall as Charles de Gaulle, Donald Dewar was taller than you are. Donald Dewar was the most erudite and elegant man, and a great scholar of early Scottish literature. I've had very few conversations in my life on the subject of Gavin Douglas's translation of the Aeneid, the Aeneidus. That's because very, very few people have read it. But Donald Dewar had read it, and had read it very attentively. For years I was infatuated with reed instruments, especially the clarinet and the tenor saxophone. And I spent a lot of time and a lot of money trying to master these instruments. But the only good thing I got out of that concentration was a poem called An Address to Adolf Sachs in Heaven. It's been published in the magazine, which is purchased by devotees of reed instruments. It's also an epic, part of it is an epigraph in Richard Ingham's Cambridge Companion to the Saxophone, one of my favorite books. And I've actually read this poem while being accompanied by a wonderful Scottish tenor saxophone player, Bobby Wishart, who's also a poetry fan. An Address to Adolf Sax in Heaven. Adolf Sax, who invented these instruments in the 1840s, worked in Paris but was Belgian. His patents were not properly registered and he was ripped off by a Parisian instrument manufacturer. His intention was for these instruments to become standard in the symphony orchestra. That didn't happen immediately. Berlioz was a fan, early fan of the instruments. Wagner was actually commissioned to come to Paris and to listen to this instrument and write a piece, but Wagner hated the sound. And there's a word by Wagner in this poem, a polite translation would be a mongrel instrument or hybrid instrument, but Wagner walked away from the commission. Sax was very disappointed, but his instruments were taken up first of all, in penny gaffs, in Parisian music halls come bordellos, and was also taken up by military orchestras. I've seen a photograph of the French Foreign Legion, 1880s, 1890s, marching out of one of these rinky-dinky Saharan forts with kepis and their tailcoats, led by a band. There are saxophones in it. I've seen a photograph of the Empress of China's army at the time of the Boxer Rebellions. Medieval-looking uniforms being led by their military band, and there are saxophones in it. And, of course, it is an instrument essential to modern dance music and jazz music in particular. Sax also invented a trombone. Was a wraparound instrument and has seven bells. And the professor of trombone at the Paris Conservatory was brought in to test drive this monstrous instrument. Took one big puff, ruptured himself, and had to be taken off to hospital. And they had to call in the fire brigade to get the instrument off. He also invented a cannon. The design of which he hoaxed the French government. It was designed to fire a shell weighing 500 tons. And he put around the rumor that the Prussians were interested. So the French government bought the designs. But the whole thing turned out, of course, to be entirely unworkable. God, that was a lecture. An address to Adolf Sachs in heaven. That your great gift to human ears offended purest connoisseurs might not be weird, but that's the word they thought described the sound they heard. Though Berlioz defended it, most maestros reprehended it, while Richard Wagner's saxophobics call for a mouthful of aerobics, Rasmussen's Klangwerkzeuge. Unrhymable, it's on its own your instrument of hybrid tone. Bizet in his L'Arlésienne, a sound like lyric Caliban, raised eyebrows as he lowered the tone with solos for a saxophone. Parisian social experts feared the sound of sex was what they heard, melodic monsters, minotaurs breaking down their bedroom doors. It's complicated quiditas, prognosticated future jazz. Not what you had in mind, Cher sax. Concertos, not yakety yaks, were more your forte. You would love the Alto One by Glazunov, Ebers, or Pierre Max Dubois' Alto Harmonious Noise. Bordellos and the regiments took greatly to your instruments. Your lacquered cosmopolitans marched under hot colonial suns. And in a room behind the bar in Senegal or Côte d'Ivoire, melodies no conservatoire would ever countenance were played. A Guadeloupean serenade, or tune to set the heart astir in an outpost of Madagascar. Saharan saxophones, Anam transfigured by their priestly calm. Think of the clarinets of France with instrumental reverence, Hyacinthe, Closet, and Leblanc, their breath the fingerprints of song. What better mouth is embouchure than one that says the word amour, or when the clarinet's played low, describes its sound as chalumeau. Its simple system, you sax built, so-called because it's difficult, found favor, but the laws of patent fail to discourage disputant competitors and plagiarists, inventions, parasitic pests. Not though your seven bell trombone that looked like the first telephone exchange, your saxotrombas, freak, ingenious saxon blatterique. That elephantine hearing aid ruptured and deafened those who played, or tried to, its enormous tones, almighty bass convulsions. Critical slander and derision postponed but couldn't halt your mission. Low audiences applauded it, and your alumni in the pit stood up in white wine sweaty brows, taking their own and their master's bows. You hoped for an orchestral story, at orchestral glory. Destiny wrote another story. Hack blowers in the music hall and quick march guardsmen in the mall. Ignored for a symphonic part, you put an oompa into art. Ballroom, nightclub, and body house were futures for your posthumous discovery. The sound of feet dancing and tapping, indiscreet lyricism in the glowing smoke. Venereal riffs and blue heartache in Harlem or in Barrowland where half the orchestra were canned. So sax profanities the fate your instruments negotiate through New Orleans to Buddy Tate while saxophonic veneries libidinous communiques disclose that St. Cecilia is just a woman when it comes to lust. From Buffs and Garde Républicaine to Charlie Parker and Coltrane, Trombar, Hawkins, Chew and Bechet, Lester, Sims and Cohn and Wardell Gray, Hodges, Webster, Rollins, Getz, Lucky, Lockjaw, Dexter, Konitz brought oompad art to that fine pitch where music's an erotic itch of fingernails too blunt to scratch. Now look at you, from Aberdeen to Hamlets in the Argentine, in Reykjavik and Birmingham, Jakarta and Dar es Salaam. High-stepping bands with majorettes play saxophones like martinets. Your beggar with its inbuilt bowls, played in the cause of rock and rolls, electric millionaires, some fusky buggers with an urge to busk. A genius who invents a noise adds to the store of sonic toys that Homo Ludens in his wisdom accepts into his playful system. Adolf, once close to suicide, cher maître, take your place beside celebrity whose household name is dictionaried in its fame. Derek the Hangman, Heinz's Beans, Kellogg's Cornflakes, Levi's Jeans, Ford of the Cars and Louis Braille, Freud, Epicurus, Chippendale, Marx and the verse, Petrarch devised, Martini and the pasteurized, Newtonian law, the arch of Goth, Macintosh's sea-proofed cloth, and Wellington, he of the boot, good optimistic King Canute, Fabian's tactics, Mills's bomb, the Midas touch, Brummel's aplomb, Platonic love, Macadam's roads, several diseases, Pindar's odes, Darwinianism, Cardigan and J.M. Barrie's Peter Pan. From saxophone quartets by Strauss on Days Off from the Opera House, or work by Mio and Ravel of Villa Lobos in Brazil, to Lester leaping in possessed by his brass-belled iconoclast. The sound we hear is yours, Adolphe, posterity, its howling wolf, time salivating on a reed and fingering at breakneck speed. My second wife, from whom I'm in a state of permanent separation, is a vegetarian. Some men, when they go away, you know, think only of committing adultery. When I would go away, I would think only of committing carnivory. I'd go cruising up the train first thing in the morning on trips to Edinburgh or London, cruising, looking for a hamburger or a bacon roll. A pathetic sight if you confronted the buffet and it was closed. Well, when I lived in France, my first wife and I arrived at the house we were renting, and the housekeeper, charming lady, had installed a hen and a little hutch and a rabbit. I thought it was meant to look after them. I thought they were pets. Madame Bellini quickly put us right the following morning when she chopped them for it. And so in the future I had to murder the rabbit and wring the hen's neck. The poem is called The Country Kitchen. It was written at a time when almost every cookbook you saw in the bookshop had the word country in it. Country equals good for you. I'm not so sure. The Country Kitchen. Madame Molinier used to bring two rabbits a week and two hens, still warm but throttled. The kitchen's cutlery lacked a decent knife, but I did the best I could, wishing there was an animal opener, the equal in convenience to what you'd use on a tin of beans. Blood seeped from the blunt incisions. Peeling each portion of their skins, the sounds were slight but bad, and such I had to shut my eyes and whistle. It felt like pulling plasters off your leg, the pain and noise of skin and hair. The heads were worst of all, the ears, the eyes, the little mouths. Blood leaked from the drainpipe. The house was bleeding. As for the hens, I plucked feathers among the trees beyond the house. It took most of an afternoon. It looked like an Indian massacre when I'd finished. Shattered headdresses. We cooked them in a big pot, sauvage, shallots, a muslin bag of herbs gathered from the neglected gardens. Some of these herbs were weeds and grasses. The dug garlic was green but good. So was the garnish of young chives. On evening walks, I used to watch the rabbits stare back from their hutch, wondering which bunny was next, and the hens pecking white dirt, dot, dot. And then the scare of a footstep. I asked a peasant to sharpen my knife on the stone he used for his scythe. It made it easier, and it didn't. My hand inside a hen's dead warmth, or slitting open the rabbits, my wife saying, keep the kidneys. Amateur kitchen pathology. So I said, I'm sick of rabbit, and another hen and I'll cluck. That village is announced by a fine sculpture. A stone woman holds a stone child. The woman's name is Abondance. I saw abundance, all right. In her stone bowls were stone vegetables, chiseled salads, a petrified artichoke. I looked with envy at the walnut trees, flourishing in botanical liberty. The fishmonger's van was maritime, cold, dripping with melting ice, an edible museum of the sea. For nights on end, I dreamt of close quarters, boxed behind the nailed mesh, creeping backwards into furred heat, packed eyes and lettuce breath, when ringed fingers dropped in on a carnivorous visit. Some years ago, when I was living in Tayport on the Firth of Tay, I could hardly help but notice the proliferation of herons in the mudflats at low tide. And so I found myself writing a poem about herons, which made me reminded me of all the poems about herons I'd ever read. They have lots of distinguished walk-on parks, vignettes, and Norma McCaig's poetry. There is that famous poem by Dylan Thomas with that wonderful phrase about the heron priested shore. An early poem by Sawley MacLean is called The Heron, which is a bird sacred in Gaelic culture. So I ended up writing a kind of anti-poem, and I've called it Unlike Herons. An aging president, an earl, two sirs, three Tory Scottish office ministers, and let them guess which ministers they are, and that dry professorial character, an airbrushed Trotsky ghosted from the snap, a moderator in a standing nap, three surgeons round a corpse, surrealists, a huddle of emaciated priests. They seem to meditate on troubled sex. A synod of mudflat ecclesiastics, one like a well-known local plasterer, and one the double of a TV star. A feathered gourmet and a rich physician, a really awful Labour politician. Oh my poor heron, what will you do? These foolish things remind me of you. This book is very recent, so I'm not very familiar with it. This is a poem from my book, Elegies. It's called Reading Pascal in the Lowlands. The poem is set in the little town of Kirkcudbright, and I had been doing, in the summer after my wife's death, I had been doing some solitary traveling around significant places, and the encounter, which is described in the poem, was something I found memorable. God knows why I was reading Pascal. The only good bit in Pascal is his theorem, known as Cleopatra's Nose. Are you familiar with it? Pascal put forward a proposition that if Cleopatra had a big, ugly hooter with warts on it, the entire history of the world would be completely different. Well, thanks very much, Pascal. I think I knew that. Reading Pascal in the Lowlands. His aunt has gone astray in her concern, and the boy's mum leans across his wheelchair to talk to him. She points to the river. An aged angler and a boy they know cast lazily into the rippled sun. They go there, into the dappled grass, shadows bickering and falling from the shaken leaves. His father keeps apart from them, walking on the beautiful grass that is bright green in the sunlight of July at 7 p.m. He sits on the bench beside me, saying, "It is a lovely evening," and I rise from my sorrows, agreeing with him. His large hand picks tobacco from a tin. His smile falls at my feet, and the baked earth shoes have shuffled over and ungrassed. It is discourteous to ask about accidents or of the sick, the unfortunate. I do not need to, for he says, leukemia. We look at the river, his son holding a rod, the line going downstream in a cloud of flies. I close my book, The Pensée of Pascal. I am light with meditation, religiose and mystic with a day of solitude. I do not tell him of my own sorrows. He is bored with misery and premonition. He has seen the limits of time, asking why. Nature is silent on that question. A swing squeaks in the distance. Runners jog round the perimeter. He is indiscreet. His son is 8 years old with months to live. His right hand trembles on his cigarette. He sees my book and then he looks at me, knowing me for a stranger. I have said I am sorry. What more is there to say? He is called over to the riverbank. I go away, leaving the park, walking through the golf course, and then a wood climbing, and then bracken and gorse, sheep pasturage. From a panoptic hill, I look down on a little town, its estuary, its bridge, its houses, churches, its undramatic streets. Two or three years ago, I published a long poem, kind of novel in verse, except I don't really think of it like that, called The Donkey's Ears. It's set at the time of the Russo-Japanese War and concerns the Russian fleet which sailed Donkey's Ears from the shape of islands in the middle of the straits, and narrated by letters of the flag engineer, Evgeny Sigismundovich Politovsky, who wrote letters home to his wife, which were published in English translation, never published in Russian because they were quite critical of the Russian naval authorities. Craig Raine published a long poem called History of the Whole Movie. It was marketed as a novel. You could get it in Remainder Bookshop 6 months after its publication. And he got £75,000 advance from Penguin. I did a 170-page poem for £8.90. I'm really not very astute. I'd like an occasion sometimes where I just read from that poem, because I could then introduce it by saying, as Dante used to say on these occasions, I'll just read from the one poem. There's a long history to my writing the poem, and the poem itself goes many places and covers a substantial period of time. So. But the first real episode of interest was the so-called Dogger Bank incident, where the Russian fleet opened fire on the Hull trawler fleet, thinking they were Japanese torpedo boats. It's not as laughable as all that, because the Japanese Navy was built on the Tyne. And the Russians were obviously well informed, because they knew that these torpedo boats, the equivalent of what we would call destroyers, had just been launched, and that Japanese crews were being trained to sail them back to Japan. Anyway, they sank a couple of Hull boats, and so this episode of Hull lore is still much remembered and discussed in Hull. So Politovsky is here writing to his wife about this incident. All Europe claims a Scythian wanderlust impels our fleet toward the yellow east. A sea-hoofed, modern Mongolian beast unmadded in the Tsardom's permafrost. Our enemy is everything that floats. I stood on the afterbridge, hot from below, and watched the needle searchlight stitch and sew a fantasy of 8 torpedo boats. Guns flashed and sucked the air from ears and lungs, each white blink showing us how we might die in nightmare, up-to-date mortality. I left the bridge rung by vibrating rung. And from the after deck, I saw our lights rake up an empty smack, then hesitate on gear and tackle, a civilian net, as sitting targets in our gunner's sights. Even a half-lieutenant whom I'd seen read treasonable pamphlets in his bunk went mad with bloodlust on the Dogger Bank, prepared to die serving a six-inch gun. If I'd been diligent with English self-taught, I might have had a name to put in this, but it went down in white analysis, in the illiterate but polyglot atrocity of sea, blood on its deck as up its stern heaved. Its legal light shone deep as garnets set against the night. Red, red for stop, that helpless rhetoric. Our modern fleet, iron arithmetic, metallurgy and engineering law, go down in scandal. A man beside me saw two fishermen hold up four half-dead haddock. Bolotovsky, ironically enough, was born and brought up in Tashkent, which, of course, is landlocked. And he was married there. His father seems to have been some government official. I've found out very little about Bolotovsky, but since the publication of his book, I have been exchanging telephone conversations and emails with a professor, lady, retired woman professor, Professor Moskova, who is the granddaughter of Politovsky's brother. And I now know much more about Politovsky than I did when I wrote the poem. The former Russian naval attaché thinks this poem is the bee's knees. He's the only one. And the Glasgow Herald reviewed it, said it was based on an Irish legend. People can take their infatuation with Irish poetry just a little too far, you know. Well, this is in this episode, Politovsky is with his mother as a child. I recollect that. Yesterday was autumn, but today it's spring. Who'd cease to be astonished by this planet? The definite, the known, the infinite. Science comforts me with its surprising discoveries, the way poetry can't get through to fact, or the material knowledge of substance, true, useful, real, workable improvements that cantos can't deliver, and never will. That's their glory. A poem measures nothing, but can cure diseased time, and make the uncertain sure, the way a child asks, tell me a story. The way a story answers to a child's deepest interest. I remember how I read of snow before I saw the snow for the first time fall on the Muscovian fields and dreamt I was dreaming, or else I thought I might be thinking it, that rhyme of white with all the wide world on that moonlight night. What did I learn that night? What was I taught? Far from Tashkent, my mother holding me. See, Eugen, she said me in German. There, I think of snow as poetry and prayer. One day, my son, I'll take you to the sea. How long have I been wittering on?
Half an hour, so
far. All right. Oh dear, more. I'd like to inflict on you a poem about adolescent sexual angst. I sometimes feel that poetry readings are too much like getting up, standing up, and reciting your private life in public, which is not really me. The poem is called If Only. It was at a moment of Lambretta's on Eastwood Mains Road, where I stood under a laburnum, waiting for her. Rich kids revved on their machines, and I'd just finished work in the library. It was 8 p.m., and the suburb glowed with prosperity. I'd my raincoat over my arm and felt stupid not to be motorized or in tennis whites, earning £5 a week and working the late shift. Dust on the pavement mixed with dropped petals and litter. A bee buzzed in my ear, a yellow interlude. It was a moment of swallows and evening sunlight on the tennis club roof, a moment populated by sports cars and resentment. My mind was far gone in lyrical grudges, drowning in leaf music and a panic. What shall I do? What's my future? And she ran towards me, hot from tennis. I couldn't believe it. I was so happy. I'd expected to wait forever or until a policeman ordered me away. I think I'm still there, haunting a gutter. If only I knew then what I still don't know. Now, this is a poem about slightly more mature sexual angst. It doesn't get any better. This is a really nasty little poem. It's just called You. You won't believe it. Perhaps you're too prosaic to fall for a poetic ache. But your smile, when you smile, your eyes, your nose, are far too beautiful for prose. Don't credit this, my dear, if you don't want to. A poem, too, can be a pack of lies. But if you don't, then I'll come back and haunt you. You'll find me hard to exorcise. Who said the Cavaliers were dead? A poem called East Riding, which is about that part of Yorkshire. You wouldn't recognize the place. It's changed. For me, though, it can never cease to be outlandish shadows, all it was, distilled into 5 minutes worth of memory, a summary of years, unsought, unwilled, arising from unasked for loping light in which my mind is disarranged and harks back to a nonspecific night dated for 1969. And there, a held hand, fragrance, leaves, a kiss, and air. It's navigation by internal stars on visits such as these into the past country, in which the dead must reappear beside me, holding on and holding fast, reluctant to be there, but ah, so dear. The leaf-trapped stars are all in place before agog in-love astronomers, who enter through a land's botanic door into themselves, with all of Holderness surrounding them and part of their caress. Some landscapes never change because they stay unvisited as too significant for our return and must remain the same. A stern but loved voice warns me off with, don't, and I obey it, drawing back from shame to tell myself, no, don't ever go back. Just let it always be the way it was. Life beaten, off the beaten track, the house in Rye Hill that we almost bought, and stars that in the starlit trees were caught. What happens, happens as it has to do, and an intelligence can try, but can't succeed in finding out all reasons why that, this, or that occurred. Recalcitrant, all life can make is its domestic cry into eternal silences untoward realm of the intimate and true, the very meaningful and the absurd. Partington's pub player piano and tea taken in Heden or in Withernsea. And I'd like to end with something a little bit more up tempo. is a poem in which I celebrate, yes, celebrate, school dinners. You never thought you'd hear anyone say that, did you? Well, the primary school I attended in the village of Inchinnan, the school dinners did not come from some subterranean municipal kitchen in big, shiny metal drums. They were cooked by a rota of our mothers, so the buzz would go round about whose mother was good at cooking. And you say, oh, God, no hurt. But on the whole, things were very good. And the subtext of the poem, in fact, it's not all that sub, is remorse for having allowed myself to become stout-ish. Given the time, the age of the children in the poem, my age, which I'm remembering, the poem is written in a kind of nursery rhyme meter. Extra helpings. In our primary school, set lunch was a rule, though in Scotland we call that meal dinner. We tucked in like starvelings and Shinnan's wee darlings, and it didn't make thin children thinner. But what I liked best was disliked by the rest. Rice pudding with raisins and bloated sultanas, stewed fruit and dumplings and big extra helpings, and hooray for first post-war bananas. It was very good scoff, so I polished it off. A very dab hand with a spoon, a very dab hand with my spoon. Detested mashed turnip gave most kids the pip, while cabbage was much the same tale. No shortage of roots and no hardship of greens. After mine, I ate Harry's, then Elspeth's, then Jean's. Oh, a glutton for turnips and kale. It was very good scoff, so I polished it off. A very dab hand with a fork, a very dab hand with my fork. I used to be slim. I used to be slim. Look, they say now, there's at least three of him. To which I reply with a daggerly eye, well, that's better than three quarters you. But my clothes don't fit. I'm fed up with it, and the sylph in me's guilty and blue. Semolina and sago with jam, with jam. Oh dear, what a pudding I am, I am. Oh dear, what a pudding I am. But I'm longing for lunch and something to munch, though I wish it was back in that school, when the dinner bell rings and all good things await to be guzzled until I am happy and full. Dear God, I'd die for shepherd's pie in 1949 or 1950, when the dinner bell rings and all good things draw children on the sniff and make them nifty. It was very good scoff, so I polished it off. Oh dear, what a pudding I am, I am. Oh dear, what a pudding I am. But a very dab hand with a spoon, and a very dab hand with a fork.
Pretty clear that no question and answer session could top that. We're going to officially dispense with one. That doesn't mean you can't ask your questions. Both Douglas and Henry are very happy to sign books. You can ask then if you wish, or you can join us for drinks afterwards and ask away to your heart's content. I believe that's the agreement. Very odd experience sitting here and seeing the two of you only in profile. It's like looking at coins the whole evening and seeing only a struck image of an emperor and wondering if ever the technology will allow you to be restored by computer animation to full 3D presence. But I'm glad now to see you're really there in the flesh, not only a profile. Let me encourage you all to... I'm just wittering. Those of you who endure my courses are used to it. The rest of you, forgive me. You have an encore in store for you. So let me just urge you all to come to the remaining sessions of Writers at Warwick this term. and, of course, to go to the book table afterwards. Henry will read one more poem, and Douglas, and then we will go to our various businesses for the rest of the evening.
Well, I'm going to read one about school as well, about drinking at school. In my miserable, rebellious years, when I wished I were elsewhere. School drinks. In those days, a good day was a sneaked pint in a pub garden, a go at a parent's cupboard, Bacardi, Advocaat, Chartreuse, whatever we found. How could they let those bottles be? Adulthood was a garden where alcohol flowed in streams. When Charlie wangled a half of Smirnoff, we didn't hesitate, crossed the playing fields to the railway arches, broke the seal with a snap. Ah, liquid fire, we gasped under our arc of glistening brick as the spirit burned to the belly. Our faces twisted with the need to hold it down. Then the light-footed scurry across the fields in the dark, the ground flowing like water beneath our boots. We scrubbed our teeth, grinning at the desperados in the mirrors, and lay on our beds, weighing nothing.
That's a relatively short poem, pretty straightforward. It's called Long Ago. In a house I visited when I was young, I looked in through a partly open door. An old man sang Long Ago and Far Away to a rocking horse, a friend's grandfather whose firstborn son was lost at sea half a century before, in a ship whose name I have forgotten. Whenever that sad song is played or sung, I'm in that house again, by that same door. A woman tugs my sleeve. Come away, she says, leave him alone. He sings, but he's no longer there. The rocking horse is rocking like the sea. Ocean is everywhere, and the room is wind and rain.